A very warm welcome to another edition of Network Europe. Coming up on the program this week, Constructing Conflict, why plans to build a mosque are stirring up debate in Cologne.
We support religious freedom, and that means we support the building of this mosque. We are against all those who are using the building of the mosque as an opportunity to try to spread their messages of hate and xenophobia in order to stir up trouble in the population.
Religious statement or fashion accessory? We speak to the designer of Turkey's First Lady. We'll find out more about this year's alternative Nobel winners. And why is Poland going through a baby boom? All this plus our latest quiz coming up on Network Europe, a partnership of Europe's leading broadcasters. This week coming to you from Bonn, Germany. I'm Barbara Grubon. Rashid Ramda went on trial this week in Paris for allegedly helping to fund a string of deadly terror attacks 12 years ago in the French capital. Prosecutors say the Algerian man was the financier of the 1995 subway bombings that killed 8 people and injured 150. Ramda was based in Britain during the attacks and was arrested soon afterwards at the request of the French authorities. He then spent 10 years in British custody, while France and the UK argued over his extradition. RFI's Sarah Elzis reports.
5 p.m. in the Saint-Michel station of Paris's RER commuter train. It's a pretty normal rush hour scene. People are hurrying to get on and off trains. But this time, on July 25, 1995, things were a lot different. A gas canister full of nails exploded under a seat, sending shards of metal flying. 8 people died and hundreds were wounded by shrapnel or crushed by the train. This man, who didn't want to be identified, said he was in the front car of the train when the bomb went off. He said he lost most of the hearing in his left ear in the blast. 24-year-old Sandrine Grière Dufournier was fatally injured. Her mother says she didn't die right away, though.
Elle est pas morte sur le coup. Elle a été amputée le lendemain des deux jambes.
She had both legs amputated the next day and died in the hospital. The now-defunct Algerian-based armed Islamic group claimed responsibility. 2 men were convicted in 2002 of carrying out the attack, and they're serving life sentences. Rashid Ramda is accused of having financed it and 2 other bombings the same year. If convicted, he too could get life in prison. He was convicted in December 2006 of associating with a terrorist group and got a maximum sentence of 10 years. Why is he only standing trial now, 12 years after the attack? Well, he was actually in England and was the subject of an extradition battle. The Home Office handed him over to France in 2005. Why did England hold on to him for so long? I called up David Bentley at London's Chatham House.
Hello?
Bentley studies extradition issues, and he explained that one of the reasons England didn't want to send Ramda to France was a suspicion that he might not have a fair trial there.
Being who he was, an Algerian sought for terrorist offences, he wasn't going to get a fair trial, which is an obvious argument, but perhaps not a very good one, because, after all, you have to put these people before a court. If every terrorist before a court is able to escape justice by saying, oh, well, you know, they're prejudiced against me from the start, we'd be nowhere.
Bentley also said that England's extradition laws at the time gave more protection to accused criminals than they do now. Since then, the process has been streamlined, both in England and throughout Europe. If Ramda were arrested today, Bentley says the process would go much faster.
I would think it would happen much more quickly, although not necessarily very quickly, because it is still possible to spin the process out, particularly if the accused person can put up some sort of case on human rights grounds and threatens to go to Strasbourg, and indeed goes to Strasbourg, to the human rights court there. So it can still be slowish, but it is faster now.
Even though Rashid Ramdas' extradition took a decade, his trial is something of a closure for some of the victims. For Mireille Glorion-Desboeufs, whose daughter died in the bombing, she wants to see Ramda convicted so other mothers don't have to suffer what she went through.
Moi, je ne veux pas que d'autres mamans vivent ça. Ça, je ne veux pas. Non, je veux pas.
The trial is set to last through the end of October. For Network Europe, this is Sarah Elzis in Paris.
A new constitution is currently being drafted in Turkey to replace the current one introduced after the military coup of 1980. But women's groups are up in arms, saying this new document is setting the country back years in terms of gender equality. Dorian Jones has more from Istanbul.
The call was made following the release of a draft which removed the article guaranteeing the equality of women. The article was replaced with a statement saying that women are a vulnerable group which needs to be protected. The proposal has caused outrage and fueled suspicions about the Islamic roots of the newly elected AK party. Supporters of the Turkish secular state have accused the government's attempts to rewrite the constitution as a way to undermine secularism. But Prime Minister Recep Tayyip Erdogan angrily rejects the charge. Erdogan has until now refused to comment on the draft constitution, saying that they will seek a broad consultation before submitting it to parliament. The new constitution has been prepared by a group of leading academics chosen by the Prime Minister. The present constitution was introduced by the country's generals 2 years after they seized power in 1980. It is widely criticized and there is strong support for it to be replaced. But the initial euphoria that greeted the government's pledges for a new, modern, democratic constitution is now being replaced by growing concerns and fears.
Dorian Jones there from Istanbul. Probably no other first lady in the world has been at the center of so much controversy this year as Ayrunisa Gül, the wife of the new Turkish president. The fact that Mrs. Gül, as an Orthodox Muslim, insists on wearing a headscarf is seen by many in Turkey as a threat to secularism. So you might not expect Mrs. Gül to draw extra attention to her wardrobe, but she clearly enjoys fashion, and in fact for her latest outfits, she went to a Turkish designer who also makes clothes for top Hollywood celebrities. Radio Netherlands' Paul Anstis reports.
The career of Atıl Kotulu sounds like a modern fairy tale. Born in Istanbul, he came to Vienna to study business. In the tramway, he got talking to the mayor of Vienna, who asked him to design some clothes for his wife. Although Mr. Kotulu had never attended a fashion school, fashion designing had always been his passion. After that, it all went very fast. Atıl Kotulu won national and international fashion awards, and more celebrities started ordering his clothes. Although he feels at home in Vienna, and he says that Viennese art has influenced his design, his main inspiration has always been the traditional fashions of his mother country.
The cut of the sleeves and the collar is a reminder of traditional Ottoman costumes. Be it the cut, the pattern of the fabric or the whole appearance, Ottoman culture always shines through in my creations.
And the combination of East and West seemed to work. People like Catherine Zeta-Jones, Naomi Campbell, Princess Michael of Kent, but also Austria's Minister for Foreign Affairs, Ursula Plasnik, have become regular customers of Mr. Kotulu. Moreover, for the Turkish community in Austria, he became a kind of a role model, one of the few who'd really made it, and was perfectly integrated into his new home country. Therefore, for many people, it came as a complete surprise that he would design a new wardrobe for an Orthodox Muslim like Mrs. Gül. Mr. Kotulu, however, considered the order as a great honour.
I was really pleased. We have been in contact for 5 years and first met at the New York Fashion Week. She told me that she'd already been interested in my work for many years.
After Mrs. Gül had ordered some scarves from Atıl Kotulu, she thought the election of her husband as president of Turkey a suitable occasion to order a whole new wardrobe. Although he doesn't want to give away any secrets, it's clear that headscarves will be part of Mr. Kotulu's designs. In a personal sense, he'll also be breaking new ground, as the last person in his family to have worn a headscarf was his great-grandmother. However, according to Mr. Kotulu, most people have the wrong impression of Mrs. Gül, whom he considers not only an intelligent and sympathetic person, but a woman of elegant presence in her Islamic dress. Moreover, he stresses that his designing of headscarves should not be mistaken for a political statement.
Es hängt natürlich mit dem Glauben der jeweiligen Person zusammen, aber...
Of course it's linked to the religious beliefs of its wearers, but I leave that to the wearers themselves. I think there have always been headscarves and turbans, and at times they were very fashionable. I prefer to see it from this point of view.
Dem Winkel, also Blickpunkt aus.
So the headscarf should not be seen as a political and religious symbol, but simply as a fashion accessory. Whether that will convince the critics of Mrs. Gul, who consider her dress the beginning of the end, is another question. However, for Atil Kotelu, the new wardrobe will have one big advantage. With Ayra Nissa Gul as a model, in the future, every Turk will be familiar with his work.
Radio Netherlands, Paul Anstis, reporting from Vienna there. Now, the headscarf issue is not only controversial in Turkey. In France, Germany and other parts of Europe, the question of wearing a headscarf in school, be it as a student or teacher, often raises the question of whether Muslims are integrated here in Europe. But it's the construction of mosques that's stirring up more debate than any other integration issues. Major mosque projects from Marseille to Amsterdam, Seville, London and Cologne have met with fierce opposition. Some fear these new mosques will serve as breeding ground for extreme Islamic views and possibly terrorism. Cologne is famous for its religious architecture, including Germany's most spectacular Gothic cathedral. But this medieval cathedral may soon share the skyline with Germany's biggest mosque. Plans are well underway to construct a mosque featuring two minarets more than 50 meters high. These plans are highly controversial, as Deutsche Welle's Elizabeth Ward reports.
With more than 200 churches and a cathedral that attracts 6 million visitors a year, religious buildings are not new to Cologne. However, plans to build a new mosque for the city's 120,000 Muslims has sparked a debate that is now examining the growing role of Islam in Germany and the success of the country's integration policy. With 10% of the population Muslim and the location of the headquarters of Germany's most important Islamic organization, DITIB, Cologne is often regarded as the German capital of Islam. In 2006, DITIB launched a competition to design a new mosque for Cologne and the surrounding area. The winning design was by Paul Böhm, who has already designed two churches in the city. Supported by all major political parties, the city's officials see the new mosque as an excellent opportunity to promote religious tolerance.
We support religious freedom, and that means we support the building of this mosque. We are against all those who are using the building of the mosque as an opportunity to try to spread their messages of hate and xenophobia in order to stir up trouble in the population.
However, with an area covering 20,000 square metres, two 55-metre minarets and a prayer room that can accommodate 2,000 worshippers, many citizens are angry at the mosque's size, yet the head of DTIP, Mehmet Yildirim, sees no reason why the plan should be changed.
We had a competition, and everyone knew what our intentions were. We have done nothing other than what was agreed. I don't see how more discussions will make any difference.
The mosque will include offices, a cafe, and even a hairdresser's, and many see this as an example of the growing Islamization of Germany. Ralph Giordano is a prominent author from Cologne who has been outspoken in his protests against the project. He sees the mosque as further evidence that the integration of the Muslim population in Cologne is failing.
This giant mosque sends a false signal. It prevents any attempt at integration from being successful. The majority of locals are against the mosque, but the politicians have acted as if that has no significance. Why haven't they asked people what they think? In my opinion, because they knew what the answer would be.
Also campaigning strongly against the project is the citizens group ProKern. According to its research, 80% of locals are against the project, and central to the group's protest is the claim that the mosque will create a Muslim ghetto. The group's leader, Manfred Ruß, explains.
There's already a mosque in the area. The Islamic representatives come from Turkey and don't speak German. We therefore have an area where the main language spoken is Turkish, and people make no effort to learn German. Turkish is spoken in the home, so the children grow up with Turkish as their native language, and they only know German as a foreign language. This means that they have great difficulties at school because they are effectively being taught in a foreign language, namely German. The consequence is that they get bad grades and subsequently have poor employment prospects, and that reinforces the presence of a Turkish ghetto.
Walking around the area where the mosque is due to be built, you get the impression that the people here are deeply divided. Many are reluctant to talk about the mosque, with those who do split between a belief in Muslims' constitutional right to practice their religion and worries about the size and consequences of the project.
Like all religious groups, Muslims have the right to build a place of worship. To be quite honest, I find all this controversy quite ridiculous.
Muslims have the constitutional rights to practice their religion, but I'm not too happy about the building. I think that it's a bit too big.
Work is due to commence in the spring of 2008, but with growing resentment on both sides of the debate, the citizens of Cologne are set for a long winter.
Deutsche Welle's Elizabeth Ward reporting on this controversial mosque project in Cologne. The winners of this year's Right Livelihood Awards were announced in Sweden this week. Dubbed by the Swedish press as the Alternative Nobel, this year's prizes are awarded to individuals and organizations working in fields as diverse as anti-nuclear campaigning, conflict resolution and the promotion of solar energy. Olof van Uxkull is the executive director of the Right Livelihood Foundation. He spoke to Radio Sweden's Azaria Kiris about the laureates. Here's what he had to say about Christopher Veeramantri, a renowned Sri Lankan legal scholar.
We awarded Christopher Veeramantri for his legal scholarship, but not only for scholarship. He is also an international activist who promotes the rule of international law. We are focused on solutions, so this is really work, the work that Christopher Veeramantri has done, that offers an opportunity to see how international law can help to solve the problem of the nuclear threat.
How important has his study proved to be?
He has, for instance, drafted a nuclear weapons convention together with others, which, if it would be signed by leaders around the world, would be the tool to abandon nuclear weapons.
And then we have Deka Ibrahim. She is from Kenya, who's been awarded for her peace work and conflict resolutions.
Deka Ibrahim Abdi is a real community peace worker who started from her own basis, from the northern Kenyan district of Wajir, because of the problems she felt on the ground. There were a clan divide in her community, a divide along religious lines. And she then brought people together in peace and development committees to get them to work on the practical issues facing them. And that has really contributed to pacifying the situation in northern Kenya. And she now goes international to spread her knowledge about how difficult, but also how effective this active peace work can be.
The third prize winner is Percy and Louise Schmeisser. The couple have given the world, according to the motivation, a wake-up call about the dangers of farmers and biodiversity.
The Schmeissers are farmers in Saskatchewan in Canada, and one day they received a letter from Monsanto suing them for infringement of patent because Monsanto-owned genes had ended up in the seeds that the Schmeissers used to plant their crop. Now, the issue is that the Schmeissers never bought Monsanto seed and never intended to have that in their plants. What had happened was that seed from another farmer who uses Monsanto GMOs were blown over to the Schmeisser's land. And just because Monsanto, according to the current interpretations of patent law, owns these genes, they then owned the whole seed of this Canadian couple. Monsanto often sues farmers in this way. This is not the only case, but what is specific about this is that the Schmeissers did not accept it and they fought back.
And finally, we have the company in Bangladesh, Grameen Shakti, which is supposed to have shown solar energy applications can be scaled up massively.
Yeah, this is a fascinating example of the potential that solar energy has in the third world. Grameen Shakti has, with microcredits from the Grameen Bank, been able to install more than 110,000 solar home systems in villages in Bangladesh, and that is regions that are off the electricity grid.
The right livelihood prizes are usually compared to the Nobel Prizes. Are you trying to compete with the Nobel Prizes?
When the Right Livelihood Award was founded in 1980 by Jakob von Uexküll, he had first offered his own money to the Nobel Foundation to give one award for ecology and one relevant to the poor in the world. So on that, but
was rebuffed.
Yes, unfortunately, the Nobel Foundation then took a decision in principle to not start any new Nobel Prizes. So the economics one should be the only one. And because he had received so much positive feedback to this idea of starting two new Nobel Prizes, he then started the Right Livelihood Award Foundation. And I think since then it has been an important compliment, also in the spirit of Alfred Nobel, who wanted to honor those who've conferred the greatest benefit on mankind. And we really believe that working for human rights, for the environment, for peace is something that even Alfred Nobel would have liked to give awards to had these issues been so high on the agenda in his lifetime as they are now.
Radio Sweden's Azaria Kiris with this year's winners of the Alternative Nobel Prize. And it's time now on the program for our weekly briefing from Brussels. Ukrainians went to the polls last weekend to finally settle a month of deadlock between pro-Western and pro-Russian parties. Election results so far show big gains for the orange coalition parties of Yulia Tymoshenko and Viktor Yushchenko. Nina Maria Potts joins us on the line from Brussels.
The European Commission has been watching this election and the results very closely. It said it welcomed the high turnout of voters. It said it took that to be a sign that the country is committed to reforms. And I think EU officials clearly watching very closely to see what happens next in light of what's been going on with Russia this week too.
Following the election results showing pro-Western parties in the lead, tensions flared up between Moscow and Kiev on gas debts. Was it just another case of Moscow flexing its muscles, or are we likely to see another autumn of tensions?
I think it will be another autumn of tensions. I think a lot has changed in just 1 year, and I say that there are probably three key things that have changed in the relationship between the EU and Russia in a very short space of time. It all started, obviously, with a single piece of aggression. The moment Russia turned off the gas taps to Ukraine in January 2006, I think that single act was the start of an emerging sense of unity, a solidarity among EU members vis-à-vis Russia. It was a tactically aggressive move. I'd argue it was strategically stupid because at that point, the trust relationship completely fell away. I think, secondly, Russia had disputes with a few former satellites, and as long as it was picking fights with smaller, newer member states, I think, most of the big, powerful EU countries basically turned away. And I think what it showed at that point was that the EU, the big EU players, weren't prepared to come to the rescue of the smaller ones. What's changed since then is that Russia has picked fights with quite big countries, some very big European countries. You have the Alexander Litvinenko case in the UK. Kremlin roughing up the British ambassador in Moscow, the members of the Nasha Youth Group. You have Estonia, trade fight with Sweden over wood, trade fight with Italy over poultry, the diplomatic tit-for-tat with expulsions with the UK. And, of course, the list goes on, and not to mention the murder of the Russian journalist Anna Politkovskaya. So I think, a year ago, Russia was essentially a friend. And I think what's significant here is that EU diplomats are saying the single biggest change since last year is that Russia is important. People agree it's important, but very few people still see it as a friend. And also, thirdly, the last point I think worth making is that there's been a massive change in the sense that there's been a big change of the EU's leadership. Characters like Chirac and Schroeder, they consider Putin a friend. Schroeder used to say that Putin was a Democrat. And you had the Nord Stream affair, which I think really shocked people here in Brussels, that Schroeder could have, one of his last acts of as Chancellor, approved the pipeline that goes under the Baltic Sea to Germany, bypassing Poland. And then, one of his first acts after he left was to become chairman of Nord Stream. I think that shocked people here in Brussels. And people see Merkel and Sarkozy as very different leaders. Merkel is prepared to talk to Putin about human rights, and I don't think Schroeder would have ever done that in a million years.
Now, We have an EU summit coming up at the end of this month. How important will energy issues be at that summit?
The answer is very, 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 very important. I think energy will, you know, completely dominate the summit. The EU has unveiled this proposal. It's trying to make much more sense of the EU energy market. Included in that proposal is an attempt to make sure that companies that supply energy shouldn't actually also distribute it, technically known as unbundling. Although the Commission says not, I think no one, well, certainly anyone I've spoken to here, is under any illusion that it's essentially a poison pill for Gazprom, which is clearly, you know, such a monopoly in its own market. And I think now it will come down to a test of nerves.
Now, Putin announced this week that he will hedge the list of the United Russia Party in the parliamentary elections in December, and he did not rule out becoming the future prime minister. What did Brussels make of this?
Well, the European Commission has been, you know, very careful not to comment on this, saying it doesn't ever comment on candidates. So in public, the European Commission has declined to comment or say anything. I think there is obviously a degree of alarm. Clearly, Putin's every move is being watched very closely this end, because it'll affect, you know, if he stays in government in a powerful role, it'll affect the future of EU-Russian relations. And the public front is not to comment. I think what's going on internally is very close monitoring.
But there were numerous human rights organizations expressing concerns as well in Brussels this week.
Yeah, and I think that's particularly interesting because the tone of voice has changed from the European Commission again since a year ago. And, you know, the anniversary, I mean, you know, moving to the human rights issue, it's the anniversary of the death of Anna Politkovskaya this month, a murdered Russian journalist. The EU says it wants as much as anyone to know what Russia is doing about it. Here's what the Commission had to say earlier this week.
And as far as the investigations into the case of the murder of Anna Politkovskaya are concerned, on the one hand, we welcome the steps taken by the Russian authorities to find the assassin. However, we deplore that they haven't brought a result yet.
So, I think the Anna Politkovskaya case, combined obviously with the Alexander Litvinenko case, they've really contributed to a very deep sense of frustration and outrage in Brussels, because both cases go very much against the EU's core values.
And that was Nina Maria Potts with this week's briefing from Brussels. We've heard a lot about declining populations and a graying Europe. But now there's an interesting new phenomenon in Poland, as the country is experiencing something of a baby boom. Statistics show the generation born in the early 80s is increasingly starting to have families. So why are the Poles suddenly discovering parenting? Joanna Neifeld from the Polish Radio External Services has been off to the maternity ward to investigate.
Demographers confirm it. In 2006, for the first time in 10 years, Poland had a positive natural growth. 374,000 babies were born, which is 10% more than the year before. All the statistics seem to suggest that 2007 will be even better. Gynecologist Ewa Ślizyn-Kuczapska works in one of the major hospitals in Warsaw.
We have never had before so many ladies pregnant. There are lots of young, but there are also more mature, more women with different health problems, in vitro clients. And of course, some of the women already have like 4 or 5 children and they still want to have more.
Two main groups account for the rise in births in Poland. One is the people born during the baby boom of the early 1980s. This young man got married a year ago when he and his fiancée were 21. Today, they're awaiting a baby.
We have each other. We have jobs to support the two of us so we can afford a baby. This is natural and we are very happy.
The other group responsible for the baby boom in Poland are those over 30 years old. They decide on having a baby now when they have already built their professional careers. Magda was an active career woman. Then, at 30 years old, she gave birth to Kalinka, and then to Maja and Marcel. Now, at 35, she's pregnant with the fourth child.
After my studies, I started my professional career in a big multinational firm.
And when I was almost 30, we decided to have a child. This completely changed my way of seeing the world around, the career, money. Nothing is so important as a family, love that we can give and love that we receive. After my second child, we decided that I quit this job. And it was a very hard decision because I earned 2/3 of the family budget. I've never regret this decision. Now we've got 3 children and we are expecting another one. Definitely we're not done. We didn't say the last word.
Although she started late, Magda is a happy mother of 4, but as Dr. Eva Schlesien-Kuczapska points out, from the medical point of view, postponing the first pregnancy too long may not always be the best idea.
So many young people are afraid of pregnancy and they take pills. They never even know that they can have an infertility problem in the future. When they find that finally they are ready to get family, sometimes it is late. Maximum fertility is between 20 and 25 years old. After 35 years old, the fertility really is going down. Those patients, they can have complications, which are not so easy to solve.
Sociologists point out that among the factors contributing to the baby boom may be Poland's economic growth and falling unemployment. It is now much easier to buy an apartment thanks to the accessibility of bank loans. A rise in planned pregnancies among university students has also been observed in large cities. A woman who can manage both family and studies is perceived as organized, credible, and responsible, and therefore more attractive for employers, say experts.
Joanna Neufeld with this report on Poland's baby boom. And that's almost all we have time for this week on Network Europe. But before we go, here comes our October quiz. At the beginning of the 20th century, a dancer called Mata Hari was the star of the clubs and soirees in Paris. Her seductive performances and exotic background captivated audiences.
I was born in the holy city of Javnapatam. My father was a highly regarded Brahmin. My mother a temple dancer who died when giving birth to me at the age of 14. I grew up as a charge of the temple priests. They consecrated me to Shiva and I was introduced to the holy mysteries of love and divine worship.
But Mata Hari was not what she seemed. Her real name was Margarete Zelle and she was born in the Netherlands, not the Far East. During World War I, she took on another role, that of spy of the German Secret Service. But her luck ran out. On October 15, 1917, Mata Hari was executed after being exposed by French counterintelligence.
I will look the soldiers in the eye. I'm proud of my past, and I was never a spy. I was Mata Hari.
The name Mata Hari means sun, but in which language? You can email us your answer. The address is contact@networkeurope.org. That's contact@networkeurope.org. Or write to us via snail mail at the European Desk, Deutsche Welle Radio, Bonn, Germany. Or check our webpage at www.networkeurope.org. Now, temperatures are cooling in Europe, but here's a hot song from Germany to keep you warm. 36 degrees by the German band Zweiraumwohnung. On behalf of the entire Network Europe team, I'm Barbara Gruber saying thanks for tuning in.
Ich komme zu euch raus.
wachsen, lässt sich grüßen, es wird nach Hause.